Well, good morning to all of you. We are going to be studying from Genesis 32, I think. But maybe let's have a children's class to begin with. I'm not sure. Maybe we can come over here. For those who are still children. So we're going to be talking about wrestling this morning. And so does anybody know what it means to wrestle? No? Yes, Grayson.
I do.
Well, let's let Grayson. No. Elise, what do you think it means to wrestle? To get exercise. Well, it could be a form of exercise. I don't think most people wrestle for exercise, though. Yes, Grayson.
Like, some people do it in a show, like,
strong. Okay, so some people do it in kind of a show to show how strong they are. So wrestling is sort of a match between two people where you try to throw the other person to the ground and hold them down. And there are a number of rules in a wrestling match. But the biggest thing is you can't hit the person. You just have to grab them and pull them around and do stuff like that. And there's another meaning for the word wrestle. So it means just to kind of struggle with something. So sometimes people will say that they're... So if you had a big suitcase and you were trying to get it in the back of your car, you could say, I was wrestling with my suitcase and I won. People don't usually say that they won. Or sometimes people are wrestling with a difficult problem or situation. They're wrestling with it. And so it just means they're struggling. And so Jacob, in our passage that we're going to talk about, was somebody who wrestled. Can you all think of ways in which Jacob wrestled? Yes, Grayson. With teaching about Jesus. Well, he didn't struggle so much with that. Yes, Victoria. Yeah. Yeah, so he did. He definitely wrestled with Laban, didn't he? He didn't actually grab him and wrestle him around, but he struggled with him. Yes, Elise. Yeah, he wrestled with Laban. The other thing is he wrestled with Esau, didn't he? And he also wrestled with God, and we're going to talk about that a little bit today. So Hosea 12, 3 through 5 is talking about Jacob, and it says that Jacob took his brother by the heel in the womb. So even when he was inside, he was a twin, right? And so there were two of them inside his mommy's belly, and he grabbed his brother, and he was wrestling with him. And it actually says that that his mother, Rebecca, so I don't think she could go to the doctor, but she cried out to God, and she said, something is not right. It's not good to have a wrestling match in your tummy, is it? Sometimes if you eat the wrong foods, it feels like that. And in his strength, he struggled with God. Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought favor from him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spoke to us. That is the Lord God of hosts. The Lord is his memorable name. So I was thinking about this, and sometimes boys wrestle with their dads. Do you ever wrestle with your dad, Grayson? No, I never wrestled with my dad either, but some, at least you don't wrestle with your dad. I know you don't, because I'm your dad. So girls don't seem to wrestle with their dads quite as much, which that could be understandable. But when I was a boy, they used to have these things called arm wrestling tournaments. Do you know what arm wrestling is? So arm wrestling, what is it, Elise? Yeah, I don't think you know. So with arm wrestling, you have two people, and they put their elbows on the table, and they lock hands, and then they try to push the other person down. And so somebody always loses and somebody always wins. And usually the person who loses has a reason why they lost. They say, well, I lost because you pushed before I was ready, or maybe I lost because your arm is too long or my arm is too short. Those are good reasons why you can use those if you ever lose an arm wrestling match. Maybe their hand slipped just a little bit and so they couldn't hold. So in this passage from Hosea, we see that Jacob was a wrestler. He wrestled with Esau and with Laban, and he even wrestled with somebody in the middle of the night. And it was either an angel or maybe it was even Jesus. So now, do you think if you were wrestling with Jesus, who do you think would win? Yes, Grayson. Yes. Jesus probably would, right? But you know, when you're wrestling with your dad... None of you wrestle with your dad, so you don't know about this. But if you wrestle with your dad, who do you think wins? Yes, Grayson. Your dad. But do you think your dad would hurt you? Probably not. And in the same way, do you think Jacob wrestled all night with this person? And the person probably could have just smushed him. Just like Elaine just killed a bug in church here. And he could have done that, but he didn't. Because he loved Jacob and he wanted to see Jacob grow. And I think a lot of people struggle with God. They wrestle with God and they're struggling with what God wants them to do with their lives or with other things that God wants them to do. And God always takes it easy on us. He only pushes us just quite so as hard as he needs to get us to go his will. Yes, Grayson. I don't know. So it's always better if we yield to what God wants us to do. Wrestling is not easy, and sometimes it leaves some hard marks on us afterwards, as we'll find out in our lesson today. So you all can go back to your parents. So we're going to be talking about a number of things this morning, but the centerpiece of our discussion is a wrestling match between Jacob and an unnamed person. And we can guess who this other party was, but we'll address that a little while later. So the Olympics happened this last summer, and one of the events that happens during the Olympics is Greco-Roman wrestling. And currently, an Olympic wrestling match takes place in 2 3-minute periods of time. And whoever pins his opponent or scores the most points in that period of time is the victor. And so it doesn't take terribly long to get through a wrestling match, I guess. But it used to be that the wrestling match had no time limit. You just went on and on and on until one of the wrestlers pinned the other one, even if it took hours. So in 1912... the Olympic Games were held in the sweltering heat of Stockholm, Sweden. And Alfred Asikainen and Martin Klein had a wrestling match that lasted 11 hours and 40 minutes. They finally ended when Martin Klein pinned Alfred. And in those days, there was no time limit. The wrestlers would just go on until there was one of them pinned. And Martin Klein, this was not the gold medal match. So Martin Klein should have wrestled the next day in the gold medal match. And he said he was so exhausted he could not wrestle. And he won the silver medal. He was just exhausted. And it was just this sort of wrestling match that Jacob was involved with. It just went on and on and on until almost dawn. And this really seems like it's the sort of person that Jacob was. He wasn't a finished man yet, and he had come to depend more and more on God. And yet, I don't think he was fully there. And as I've been studying the story of Jacob, I think that Jacob is the patriarch that I identify most with. Unlike Abraham and Isaac, he worked really hard for everything he got. He seems to have had challenges all the way along, and here we find him right between two of those challenges, between Laban and Esau. And I think that we know in our own lives there are seldom times when we have no challenges, and maybe if we ever have those times, it just feels kind of boring to us. Even in those brief moments when we think we have a moment to catch a breather, we can see challenges on the horizon. John 16, verse 33, Jesus was talking to his followers at the Last Supper, and he said, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." And I love this verse because it says two things. It says we're going to have trials, and that feels real. Every one of us is going to have trials. If I stood up here this morning and said, you know what, if you just have enough faith, God will give you life in abundance and you will have no trials, you would laugh at me. You'd say, that's just not realistic. But the second thing is that Jesus has overcome them all. And that's a blessing, isn't it? The point is not that signing on the Christian life is to sign on to a life free from all adversity, but that signing on to follow Jesus gives us a companion who is stronger than the strongest man, more faithful than the most loyal friend, and has the wisdom to see us through it all. As Hosea 12, 3 verse through 5, I've read this already. He, that is Jacob, took his brother by the heel in the womb, and in his strength he struggled with God. Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought favor from him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spoke to us. That is the Lord God of hosts. The Lord is his memorable name. And I don't want to rehash all the things we talked about in children's class. You all were listening. But we see that Jacob was constantly wrestling, trying to gain the upper hand. He did this against Esau. He did it against Laban. And now today, he did it against a pre-incarnate Jesus. And this passage comes in the middle of a prophecy of Hosea talking about the problems of both Israel and Judah and the ways in which they had chosen not to follow God. And the thing about Jacob was that he continued to focus himself on God even though he wrestled with him. And Israel and Judah did not wrestle with God anymore. They had turned away from him. And I believe this morning that God would rather have us wrestle with him than turn to false gods. It's okay to wrestle with God as long as we're still focused on him. He's not going to give up on us. And yet at the same time, I hope that at some point we can come to the place where we can realize that God's way is best. Let's read Genesis chapter 32. Genesis 32, so Jacob went on his way, and angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. Now, then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." Then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you. And 400 men are with him." So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were there with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two companies. And he said, "If Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company, which is left, will escape." Then Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you,' I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown to your servant. For I crossed over the Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, 'I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.' So he lodged there that same night and took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 foals. Then he delivered them to the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass over before me, and put some distance between successive droves." And he commanded the first one, saying, "When Esau my brother meets you and asks you, saying, 'To whom do you belong and where are you going? Who are these in front of you?' Then you shall say, 'They are your servants, Jacob, servant Jacob's. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us.'" So he commanded the second, the third, and all who followed the drove, saying, "In this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and also say, 'Behold, your servant Jacob is behind us.' For he said, 'I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present went on before him, over before him, but he himself lodged that night in the camp. And he arose that night and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. He took them, sent them over the brook, and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he, that is Jacob, said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said unto him, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why is it that you ask about my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place, name of the place, Peniel, "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." Just as he crossed over Peniel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip and the muscle that shrank. So let's just kind of break this passage down a little bit, and then we're going to go into some lessons that I think we can learn from it. So the name Mahanaim signifies camps. And I'm guessing that Jacob saw two camps here, his camp and a camp of an angelic host that was also present. And we're surrounded by angels and forces that we're not aware of. And I suppose it's probably a good thing that we don't see them. It'd probably fill us with a lot of dread if we could see them. I don't know if you all remember the story of Elisha and his servant, and Syrians had come and surrounded the city where Elisha was, and Elisha's servant looked out, and he was scared. There's lots of Syrians here, they're in a small town, and there's just no escape. And in 2 Kings 6, verse 17, Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And this is the picture of the heavenly hosts that surround us. They're greater than what we understand, and they make a difference. We don't understand all of that. God sent messengers to Jacob, and we don't know much about this experience, but it seems likely that Jacob had some sort of a vision of angelic messengers. And the interesting thing here is that just as soon as Jacob saw the divine messengers, he sent messengers also to speak to Esau. So God was telling Jacob, "Jacob, I'm going to take care of you." He told him that multiple times, hadn't he? And Jacob wasn't sure. He remembered how he had parted from Esau, and he wanted to make sure that he was going to dwell in peace when he came back. So up to this point, Jacob was mostly motivated by his anger and frustration with Laban. But suddenly he remembers that 20 years ago, he and Esau had not parted under the best of circumstances. And we won't take a lot of time to talk about this, but Jacob had bought, or Esau would have said, stolen his birthright and stolen a blessing. And whether or not God would have given him some of these things in the end anyway, Jacob hadn't made his relationship with Esau very good, had it? And so this messenger goes off and comes back, and what he brings back wasn't very good. He says, Esau's coming, that's okay, and he's got 400 men with him. And I don't know what Jacob was thinking here exactly, but it scared him to death. Jacob had a lot of stuff, but he had no military might. He didn't have a little army. He didn't have a bunch of swords and spears and things like that. And we know that Jacob was afraid and distressed. It says that the Hebrew literally means, then was afraid Jacob extremely and distressed. It's not good English word order. If you were writing a paper in school and you turn that into to Mr. Bowman, he's going to have a comment on your word order. But in Hebrew, I guess it's okay. But the point is that Jacob was terrified. The last time Esau and Jacob had parted, Esau was threatening to kill Jacob, and now Esau's coming with 400 men, and Jacob can do nothing about it. So what could you do in that situation? So fleeing seems like a good option, but where would you go? How quickly could you get there was the challenge, because of Jacob's flocks and family could not move very quickly. And apologizing seems like maybe a good option to me, but Jacob didn't really ever go down that road. Maybe he thought it would come across as fake, but he just didn't do much. So his scheming mind takes over, and he divides his camp. And he says just flat out, if my camp is attacked, the other camp can maybe get away, and vice versa. So I think that Jacob was a pretty pessimistic person, but he knew that he wasn't going to beat 400 men, and he didn't really want to fight a battle anyway. So he prayed. And that's probably what he should have done in the beginning anyway, right? And yet we tend to wait until we've exhausted all the other efforts. So we've taken all the, I think about it maybe as people, when do you go to the doctor? Well, you go to the doctor when you've used all the home remedies you can think of and they've just exhausted them all and things just aren't working so well. And you're like, okay, well, maybe there's a little medical knowledge in this world that could help me. Not sure about it, but we'll give it a stab. So what are the elements of his prayer? He says that God is his father, the God of his father and his grandfather. And I think the reason why he phrases it this way is because of his humility. Jacob is saying, I am not worthy to be your servant, but my father and grandfather were your servants, and on their behalf, would you work something wonderful for me? He moves on to say that the reason he's returning to the land is because of God. So God told him, go back to the land and I will take care of you. God, you know, you remember, it's only a few months ago you told me that. So he's trying to say that God got him into this and God has a responsibility to take him out of this situation. He confesses himself not to be worthy of God's blessing, and humility tells God that it's precisely because of God's blessing that he has become two companies. Literally, he is rich enough that he can separate his company into two companies and still have them both be good-sized. And finally, comes to the crux of his prayer. He needs God's mighty protection against Esau. He told God that he was afraid of Esau, and he seems to say, at least God protect my wives and their children. And he finishes with a message of God's promise to him to establish him in the land and to make his descendants numerous. He doesn't out and out tell God this, but clearly he's saying, if our whole company is wiped out, there won't be any descendants left, and your promise is going to be all messed up. So Jacob prays. And yet he doesn't have a whole lot of faith, does he? Because then he also gets together a big gift. So he sends Esau a whole bunch of stuff. 3 servants were dispatched, each with a bunch of livestock. There were 30 milk cows, camels. Wow, camels. I thought it was interesting thinking about camel's milk. So apparently people have been milking camels for a very long time. How many of you all have milked a camel? No one. I'm shocked. So I'm not sure that Myron is going to sell all his cows and buy camels, but there are apparently millions of pounds of camel's milk produced every year. Camel's milk is very healthy. It's low in sugar and cholesterol, high in vitamin A, B, C, D, E, calcium. And supposedly camel's milk is the closest thing in the animal kingdom to human milk, so it doesn't contain casein, so there's much lower risk of milk protein allergies that we see with cow's milk. I hope this has inspired all of you to go out and purchase a camel to milk, or at least buy a big supply of camel's milk. It's actually really expensive. I looked it up, and it takes about $16 for a pint. So it's not cheap. So I think we're going to stick with cow's milk at our house just because of cost. But part of the problem is that camels don't produce a huge amount of milk, and they can't be bred until they're 4 years old, and they have a long gestation period. So there's a number of reasons why we milk cows in this country and not camels. Also, I think camels are probably grumpier than cows, I'm guessing. Anyway, regardless, he sent milk camels. So you all ever thought about milk camels? You probably haven't. I didn't until I read this. I thought, well, that's interesting. What about milk camels? Apparently they're a thing, mostly in East Africa. So there were oxen, donkeys, sheep as well that he sent to Esau. Jacob had connived and cheated to get whatever he could out of Esau. Now he was returning the birthright he had stolen. He realizes that what he had taken was not as important as his relationship with his brother. So now we come to the part where Jacob wrestles, and I want to spend most of the rest of the time thinking about this. So Jacob is alone here. He's terrified, he's at the end of himself, and at this point, a stranger comes up and begins to wrestle with him. The identity of the stranger is never told to us, but Jacob says afterwards that he has seen God face to face. And so a lot of people, at least Christians, believe that this is a pre-incarnate Jesus who comes and wrestles with him. So I think of the Apostle Paul, and he was full of zeal. He desired to single-handedly end the early church, didn't he? He even got letters to go to Damascus and begin to persecute Christians there. In Acts 26, verse 14, the Apostle Paul is telling the story of his experience seeing a bright light on his way to Damascus and getting knocked off his horse. He says, "And when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice speaking to me and saying in the Hebrew language, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads.'" And what does it mean to kick against the goads? Well, I think there's 2 aspects of this. First, a goad is intended to get an animal to behave, to do what the farmer intends. So in the same way, God wants us to go in a general direction, and we kick back against his prodding to get us to go the way that he wants. And so back in those days, they would take a pointed stick and they'd put it behind an animal, and if the animal tried to back up or tried to kick out, it would run into this pointed stick and it would jab them, and they would move forward. They'd move the direction the farmer wanted them to go. But the second thing is that it is useless to kick against the goads. The goad is an inanimate object. If you kick or back up into it, it hurts you worse. And it does nothing to the goad, does it? The goad isn't bothered. It's like, whatever. I think Jesus was telling Paul that he had been trying to get through to Paul a long time and finally had to knock him off his horse, send a blinding light, in order to get his attention. Paul's life was completely changed as a result of this. We could say that his world had been turned upside down. But once Jesus got through to him, there was no going back. And I think this is a little bit of that kind of experience. This is the point at which Jacob's life really changed. I think it's important to know that while Jacob was going all out, God was exerting just enough force to push him in the right direction. So they're wrestling, and Jacob is putting every single bit of effort he has into this wrestling match. He is shaking with the effort that he's making, trying to throw this unnamed person to the ground. And God is there, gently pushing back on him. Just enough effort not to hurt Jacob, but to get him to do what he wants to do. God never wrestles with us in anger, but that doesn't mean that his heart doesn't break for the direction that we take sometimes. Verses on chastening in Hebrews seem appropriate. Hebrews 12, 6 through 11 says, "For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons." So wrestling is different from chastening, but I think of chastening as being almost punishment to get us to give up evil, while wrestling is pushing back against God's will. And we have here a wrestling match that went all night long. Jacob wasn't winning. He never was winning, but he wouldn't give up. And close to daybreak, the stranger made as though to leave, and Jacob grabbed hold of him and would not let him go. The stranger touched Jacob on the hip area and dislocated Jacob's hip. And it says something about this stranger's power that he was able to do that just by touching him, right? It says, what could he have done at the beginning of the night if he wanted to? And we need to picture Jacob being knocked down over and over again, struggling to his feet, and with his last desperation, in an agony of pain, grabbing hold of the stranger and crying out that he desires a blessing. And at this point, the stranger asked Jacob what his name was. God knew Jacob's name. It meant heel grabber, deceiver, usurper, nothing good. And the angel said that in return, that no longer would this be Jacob's name. He wouldn't be Jacob any longer. He would be Israel, meaning contending or wrestling with God. And the point, though, is that not only does he wrestle, but he prevails, he perseveres through. And then Jacob was wounded as a result of this. He never walked the same again. When his family next saw him, he was in tatters, his clothes torn, maybe he was bleeding from certain spots, and he is hobbling along like an 80-year-old man. He would never walk the same again. And yet his life was changed for the better. Maybe it was changed for the worse because he had a limp, but it was changed for the better because he'd had an experience with God and nothing could take that away. So what are some things that we can learn from this story? First of all, we need to learn to pray like Jacob. So we need to come to God in humility. I think a lot of us have a bit of a feeling that God is lucky to have us as one of his servants. And as such, we deserve to have our prayers answered quickly and in the affirmative. And the reality is that we have nothing really to leverage God. We crawl before him in supplication, knowing that it is only because of God's goodness and not our own worth that we receive an answer. We need to be honest with God about our petitions and the emotions that are associated with them. God knows these things already, and yet he wants to hear it from our own lips. And we should feel comfortable bringing God's promises up to him. The Bible is full of statements about God's love and mercy and his faithfulness, and it's okay to tell him about them. And unfortunately, our tendency is to wait until the point of our desperation to cry out to God. And of course, he is sure to hear us then, regardless of when we call to him, but maybe we'd do better to call earlier. The only time you call your parents is when you need money. They're you know, they could be kind of discouraging for your parents. Psalms 34, 17 through 19, the righteous cry out and the Lord hears. And that is a promise and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to those who have a broken heart and saves such as have a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers them out of them all. Wrestling with God. Some of the most important times in our lives come when we are alone. And I think, you know, depending on who you are, maybe you don't like being alone. Maybe you're not used to being alone. I grew up in a family that had 7 children, and Elaine and I have 5 children, and we're not alone. I haven't been alone a lot over the years. There's always seems like there's somebody coming in. You know, some of you, even when you go to the bathroom, there's somebody knocking on the door. And yet, there's a benefit to being alone. We won't literally wrestle with the physical presence of God, but we do wrestle with our understanding of God's will, our ability to carry it out, and who we really are. And I think these are alone times are really important. Jacob had been wrestling with God a long time before this account. He believed that there were better things for him, and he didn't know for sure that God was on his side. He was struggling to receive the blessing of God. And that's what this wrestling was all about, wasn't it? That's why he stole the blessing from his brother Esau. It's why he was up all night pushing on this man. Jacob deceived his father. He works weird things with sticks to try to get the better of Laban. And at some point, God appeared to him and told him, "You know what, Jacob? I will bless you." And Laban even said it, didn't he? Laban said, "It has been revealed to me that my herds have grown because of your presence and God's blessing on them." It's clear to everyone reading this story that Jacob is blessed. God has promised his blessing on him and has already wonderfully blessed him. And yet Jacob is still struggling and grasping and crying out for God's blessing. And I wonder if we aren't the same way. We don't understand that God is working something wonderful in our lives, even in the moments that we find most challenging. And Jacob got a new name, Israel, which means one who struggles with God. It contains within it a concept of prevailing as well as struggling. The point is persevering. I'm thinking of the widow who wanted to be avenged of her adversary and pestered a judge every day about it. The judge finally gave in because of her perseverance. Jesus said that we ought also to persevere in prayer. Never give up. So do we understand the concept of names? Jacob had lied about his name to his father. He told his father, "I am Esau." And here he speaks his name with all its history and meaning and stories behind it. And God, hearing this, names him something else. There's a skier by the name of Peekaboo Street, and her parents didn't name her for 3 years after she was born. They just called her baby girl, which is kind of odd to me. And finally, when she was 3 years old, they decided on a name for her. As far as I can tell, she ended up getting named based on a nearby town, which is very strange too. When God names us, a name reveals something about who we are, but it also reveals about something about who we will be. And then the final thing is that when we wrestle with God, we will be changed by the experience. Jacob limped for the rest of his life. This was a terrible thing and a wonderful thing. Our goal should never to be sit like a child filled with emotions in a revival meeting, only to walk out the door and into our own lives, but to limp out, realizing that we are not the same person and we can never be the same person again. We are a new creation. We are called to something better, something holier. We walk with a limp, and as we limp along, we realize that we have put the darkness behind us and we have turned towards the light. I'm afraid that too many of us are challenged by sermons and not enough of us are changed by them. I would ask you this morning, how are you wrestling with God? What does He want you to change in your life, to do differently, to put aside or to turn towards? And even if it's hard, start limping in that direction. John Newton was at sea from the time he was 7 years old. When he was 18 years old, a British Navy ship pressed him into service. John didn't have a choice, and when he tried to desert a while later, they had him flogged and reduced his rank to that of a common seaman. John didn't get along with the crew of the ship, and they eventually gave him to a West African slave dealer named Amos Clowe, who in turn gave John as a slave to his wife. According to Newton, she abused and mistreated him just as much as she did the other slaves. And Newton later recounted this period as a time when he was once an infidel and libertine, a servant of slaves in West Africa. He was eventually rescued and on his way back to England. So his father had sent somebody out to redeem him. The man came and redeemed him, bought him back, and took him with him to England. On the way back to England, apparently the ship had been out for over a year from port, and they ran into a storm. The ship was falling apart. They could hardly get it through. They were at the pumps trying to get the water out of the ship, and John was certain that the ship would sink, and he cried out to God that he would save them. Even as he was praying, John felt the storm begin to abate. And on reaching Ireland, Newton went to a church and immediately gave his heart to God. He wasn't changed in an instant. He had some down times, but eventually he went back to England and became an Anglican minister and wrote a hymn book with William Cooper and worked to have the slave trade abolished. There are many stories of people who knew what was right from an early age, but required some time of wrestling with fear and distress before they were willing to follow the way that God had for them. And if we think about the first verse of John Newton's song, it tells us so much. So John Newton wrote an autobiography called Out of the Depths. And the very first part, very first thing in that book is the song Amazing Grace. It says, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see." Jeremiah 6, verse 16, "Thus says the Lord, stand in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths where the good way is, and walk in it. Then you will find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk in it." The book of Jeremiah is heartbreaking because we see how clearly it was that God set before the people the path that would lead to good places and how much the people pushed back against that. They were certain that they were doing enough, offering enough sacrifices, following the Torah just enough to satisfy God, even as they grasped their idols and abused their slaves and committed immoral acts. Surely we are not like these people, and yet I am afraid that we too wrestle with God. It is hard for us to fully surrender our will to His. Maybe it is that we think His way is too hard, that we'll need to give up too much, but we follow Him half-heartedly, dragging along. I pray that we might have the zeal that the Apostle Paul showed after his conversion. Once he'd been wrestled to the ground by God, his heart was changed, and he pursued a new path. Even though that path led to hardship and suffering, it also led to life.